Star Trek, Maverick. The Frontlines. Join the USS Maverick, the newest Galaxy-class starship guarding the border of the Federation and the distant Delta Quadrant following the events in Star Trek, First Contact. When the Maverick is called on to investigate the loss of communication with several Federation colonies on the Rim, Chris Larrabee discovers an ancient enemy with startling links to the Borg who may be even more dangerous than the Collective. Rated, General. No prior knowledge of the Magnificent Seven is required. The crew of the Maverick are Captain Chris Larrabee, Commander Buck Wilmington, First Officer, Lieutenant Commander Alex Stiles, Science Officer, Lieutenant Commander Ezra Standish, Chief of Security, Dr. Nathan Jackson, Chief Medical Officer, Counselor Josiah Sanchez, Ship's Counselor, Lieutenant Julia Pemberton, Chief Engineer, Lieutenant Vin Tanner, Officer of the Kai, Ensign J.D. Dunn, Navigator, Yeoman Casey Wells, Captains Yeoman and Ines Resillos, Head Bartender of Four Corners.
Being in command was about taking the responsibility of making a judgment call. As a Starfleet officer, the reality of it held more substance than the uniform, the stars, or even the ship to which one belonged. The judgment call was that moment every cadet, dreaming his wildest during one of those boring astrophysics classes, prayed for. When the cadet wears his officer's pips for the first time, the excitement of that moment dies a little because it is tempered by reality. The judgment call decided whether one lived or died, held ground to fight or simply slink away in defeat. It was the gauge by which the mettle of every Starfleet officer was tested. Those who could make the call could aspire to the ranks of the Federation elite, becoming legends like Archer, Garth, Pike, and Kirk. Those who could not, became foot soldiers forgotten by history. For Commander Christopher Larrabee, First Officer of the USS Rutherford, the call was now.
This is Captain Picard of the Enterprise. I'm taking command of the fleet. Target all of your weapons onto the following coordinates. Fire at my command.
Chris stood there, looking at the view screen in silent contemplation. Around him, the bridge was a smoldering wreck. Only half the consoles and stations were actually still in operation, while live wires and conduits hung loosely from shattered paneling and twisted bulkheads. The bridge was bathed in a reddish glow, with klaxons screaming out the inevitable death knell of the ship. Captain Saville was dead. He, Chris Larrabee, was in command. He was in command of a Nebula-class starship about to die fighting the Borg over the planet Earth. The Admiral of the fleet, from which whom Picard had suddenly seized control, was also gone. All avenues of escape had been sealed. The call had him surrounded. He took a deep breath, wiped the sweat from his brow, ignored the bleeding he could feel under his uniform and took a final look at the faces around him. Some were rookies, cadets fresh out of the academy, while others were seasoned, logging in hundreds of hours of star time. Yet now they all wore the same expression, the same expectation. Picard had no right to take command of the fleet. The Admiral had deemed him an unnecessary liability. Chris did not believe that estimation was fair. Any man who could retain his sanity after the nightmare of assimilation should not be disregarded so easily. But following Picard's command was a violation of orders. Chris took a split second to decide, and the thoughts that ran through his mind were many. A thousand lines of Starfleet regulations flashed in front of his eyes. Words like insubordination and court-martial flashed through his mind. But this was Captain Jean-Luc Picard. One, the man responsible for the Picard maneuver. The Starfleet captain who had engineered a truce with the warlike Gorn. The man who commanded the first attacks against the Ferengi and prevented a Romulan invasion of Vulcan. Picard's achievements spoke not of delusions of grandeur but an almost iron will to survive all odds with the greatest dignity, and that made Chris Larrabee's decision all the harder.
Lieutenant Tanner.
He turned to the junior navigator and helmsman that had been forced to take tactical when the officer in charge of the post had died minutes ago.
Signal the Enterprise, we will comply.
Tanner had only been transferred to the Rutherford in the last 2 weeks, and he was almost fresh out of a frontier posting that saw very little action. Chris could hardly imagine what was going through his mind at the moment, but the young man was holding together exceedingly well.
Commander, that's a violation of Starfleet orders. Captain Picard does not have authorization to take command of the fleet.
This came from Lieutenant Commander Watts. Watts was his science officer and a very proper Englishman who lived by the book with visible gaps in his knowledge as to the spirit behind its high-minded ideals. Judgment call, Chris. Now's the time. Chris turned to Watts and said simply,
Lieutenant Commander Watts, you will fire on the coordinates designated by Captain Picard. Consider that an order.
Watts wanted to argue, but the look on the faces of not just his commander, but of the others on the bridge, changed his mind. He nodded mutely and went to the station formerly occupied by the now deceased security officer. He stared at the erratically flickering console before meeting Chris's gaze again.
Sir, these coordinates are not even for any major system on the cube.
Chris glared at the man with a look of ice. Command officers needed to project a united front. This time more than any other, Chris wanted that kind of strength to boost morale among his junior officers. Watts's ignorance of this principle angered him intensely. However, now was not the time to address the man's conduct. The Rutherford was lost. Everyone on the bridge knew it. A determined lieutenant who was holding things together with her spit to ensure that the Rutherford went down with honor was manning the engineering deck. Before she was done, Chris Larrabee was going to give the Rutherford her day.
Fire at Picard's command.
Yes, sir.
Watts replied, visibly contemptuous of the decision and his being forced to aid in what he deemed to be a violation of orders. Chris watched the cube flinging tendrils of unrestrained power at the starships around it. The behemoth showed no signs of relenting, and the dark space above the Earth was littered with the debris of Starfleet's finest. To those thousands who lay dead in the vacuum, resistance was indeed futile. Picard's signal came through the speakers and Chris responded in kind.
Fire all weapons.
The Rutherford gave it her all. Power spewed out from damaged phaser banks and photon torpedo tubes. The combined power of the remaining fleet came forth like a brilliant cascade. The cube twisted slightly under the strain, and for a moment, it seemed that Picard's gamble was indeed a fool's errand and they were all going to see the Earth destroyed. Suddenly, the Borg ship began buckling under a series of explosions all across its hull. Bulkheads exploded outward, debris flying in all directions. In a split second, it was completely enveloped by a large cloud of detonation. The shock wave expanded like a ring forming around a new star. As he watched as it cascaded towards the ship, and Chris knew instantly that in its present condition, there was no way that the Rutherford was going to survive the impact. He touched the communication device on his chest and almost shouted,
"All hands abandon ship. Repeat, all hands proceed to emergency life pods immediately."
He said the words just as the shock wave hit. Chris and everyone else on the bridge went flying at the impact. Everything that was not bolted down became airborne. Glass, debris and bodies moved like a cascade of their own as the shock wave swept the Rutherford away. Klaxons that were screaming before had terminated abruptly, and that silence was even more frightening. He felt pain grip his ribs as he landed. As his weight came down, he felt the world go black as the floor came up and swallowed him whole. He woke up a week later in a hospital at Starfleet Medical on Earth. Commander Chris Larrabee woke up to find himself about to receive the Federation Citation of Honor for his bravery under fire. Captain Picard's strategy had destroyed the Borg and saved the Earth. Those who had followed his banner of violation were apparently the saviors of the homeworld, and like all heroes, were given ceremonious congratulations. He learned that half of his crew survived the battle with the Borg, and most of those had reached the life pods when he gave the order to abandon ship. The young lieutenant, whose name he learned was Julia Pemberton, the one who held the engineering deck together, had transported out before the shock wave tore the underside of the ship apart. Chris mourned all the lost lives from his bed, Despite the agony of their deaths, he took some small comfort in the fact that when the time came, he had managed to act accordingly. He had made the call and they promoted him for it. At the age of 38, Chris Larrabee was going to be a starship captain. Chapter 1. Balances. Captain Chris Larrabee paced the floor of Admiral Wellington's office, trying to calm himself down before he met the man in a few moments. He ran his fingers through his dark gold hair and wondered if the heat was due to his mood or the temperature outside. Wellington's secretary seemed to view his ability to curb his temper with skepticism as she glanced up occasionally from her desk to check on his progress. Chris paced the carpeted floor for the 100th time before concluding that he was going to be exhausted long before he wore out the carpet. As an act of defiance, he chose to sit down again. Outside the huge picture window of the annex preceding the Admiral's inner sanctum, his intense blue eyes could see the Golden Gate Bridge under the powerful rays of the noonday sky. It was a typical Californian day in San Francisco this afternoon and he wished he were out in it, instead of preparing a confrontation with the man who had given him his new command. However, Chris was stubborn in his belief that a captain should have the right to select his own officers, not have them chosen for him. A protocol officer. Why did he need a protocol officer? He had nothing against the importance of the role. Not at all. However, Chris felt that it should be his choice whether he needed one and not have some stranger forced on him. Truth be known, he could probably use one considering that much of the Maverick's mission would involve first contact situations, but that still did not give them license to usurp what should have been the fundamental right of any captain. If truth be known, he had no candidate in mind for the position, but Chris wanted the freedom to make the search himself.
"The Admiral will see you now,"
Wellington's secretary finally responded. Reasonably calmer, Chris rose to his feet and walked towards the doorway leading to Admiral Richard Wellington. Wellington was one of Starfleet's more seasoned and decorated officers. During his years on the Excelsior and later the Hannibal, Wellington had proven himself against the Romulans and the Cardassians. As an administrator of what was now called the Frontier Territories TIF for Starfleet High Command, he was known for making unusual choices in fleet appointments. Wellington did not just assign captains for his starships, he also handpicked crews with certain allowances to captain's choice. Admiral Wellington was seated behind a polished oak desk of almost ancient design. These days, Starfleet decor was mostly slanted towards modern ergonomically designed furnishings and Chris had to admire the craftsmanship of the desk. He was a man in his 60s, well-preserved with a rakish bearing for his age. His dark hair was slowly turning gray and his gray eyes appeared as sharp as always. Wellington looked up at Chris from behind his steel-rimmed glasses over a pile of data pads. Immediately, Chris regretted not contacting the Admiral by comscreen instead of interrupting him in person.
"What can I do for you, Captain Larrabee?"
The man sat back in his chair and eyed Chris's entry into his office.
"I wish to speak to you about the crew assignments."
Chris still had trouble adjusting to the fact that he was now a captain of a starship instead of just another junior officer, especially when he was addressing an admiral.
"What about the crew assignments?"
Wellington's gray eyes narrowed.
"We have tried to place all your requests."
"It's the position of the protocol officer."
Chris decided to plunge in and just say what was on his mind.
"I thought it was my choice whether or not I needed one."
"Under normal circumstances, yes. However, you are one of the youngest captains in the fleet and that does change things slightly."
Chris bristled at the mention of his age, a fact not lost on Wellington.
"Sir, I thought after promoting me to captain, My age would not be a deciding factor in such matters.
Wellington liked Chris Larrabee. He was determined, stubborn, and he knew how to leap beyond what was required and take a risk when it was warranted. The Borg attack had proved that much. Many other officers in the same position had faltered when Picard took the initiative. Officers, who could put aside the risk to themselves for the sake of all, should not be wasted. The Admiral knew a potential candidate for the elite when he saw it, but Chris had a long way to go before he reached those ranks yet.
"Your ability is not in question, Captain,"
Wellington responded with a touch of ice to emphasize that this discussion was at his good graces only. By right, he could simply make it an order and Chris would have to suffer it whether he liked it or not.
"However, you tend to be reckless and headstrong."
"But a protocol officer? I don't even know what he does."
"She does,"
Wellington pointed out.
"Whatever,"
Chris replied. He had not read that far down the file before he had come marching up to Wellington's office. Suddenly, he found himself in partial agreement with the Admiral's assessment of his rash nature.
"Lieutenant Mary Travis is highly recommended. She is personally responsible for negotiating several prisoner releases with the Dominion, has spent time on the border, and in more recent years has been the Starfleet liaison with the Vulcan Embassy. You're lucky to get her."
"Sir,"
Chris took a deep breath.
"I have no problems with the position of protocol officer, I just question our compatibility in working together."
"I do not. If I'm not mistaken, Jean-Luc Picard has had the aid of a protocol officer on his bridge and the Enterprise has gone down in history."
"With all due respect, I am not Picard and Lieutenant Travis is not a Betazoid empath."
"But the balance works just the same. Picard took the advice of Counselor Troy since her role was more or less the same as the protocol officer without question. Are you telling me that you deserve better than Jean-Luc Picard?"
Chris opened his mouth to speak but somehow thought better of it. He suddenly had the insight that whatever he said would not change Wellington's mind.
"Of course not, sir."
"Good."
Wellington rose to his feet. For a man in his 60s, he matched Chris's height of 6'1" and was able to meet the younger man's gaze directly.
"Lieutenant Mary Travis will report to you on the Maverick as ordered at 1400 hours tomorrow."
Chris nodded in response. Knowing how to take a hit when it was unavoidable, he did not know why Wellington was so determined that he take on Lieutenant Mary Travis, but he assumed there was a good reason for it. In any case, it was out of his hands now. Chris was starting to believe it always had been.
"Yes, sir."
"Dismissed."
Wellington put the final nail into the discussion. Chris turned around to leave when suddenly Wellington spoke.
"Captain, a starship needs balances. With Lieutenant Travis as your protocol officer, the Maverick will have some."
Suddenly, Chris felt somewhat disarmed from his previous anger.
"You really think that I need a protocol officer?"
He was suddenly interested in Wellington's reasons for making this decision. Chris was still resentful that he had not been allowed to make the choice himself, but he was not so arrogant as to ignore the assessment of someone who had more experience and years under his belt.
"Yes, I do."
Wellington decided to give him a straight answer if that would make the assignment easier to accept.
"You're a good officer, Chris, but you need tempering. You need a protocol officer who can give you alternatives you've never considered. The choice of selecting your own first officer is a captain's right. I won't presume to take that from you. Wilmington has an excellent service record, but he's a lot like you. He shoots from the hip. So, if you want Wilmington, you're going to have to take Travis."
Chris let out a sigh, knowing that despite his reservations, Wellington's words had affected him. He was a first-time starship captain and all the lives under his command were his responsibility.
"Thank you for your candor, sir, and your patience. I hope you're right."
"Trust an old man on this one."
Wellington grinned. He knew Chris's change of heart was not because the order was irrefutable but because he had seen the sense in Wellington's arguments. A man who could admit he was wrong was rare and Chris was living up to his every expectation.
"I don't know how this will work with Lieutenant Travis, but I assure you, I will do my best to work with her and take her ideas into consideration."
"That's all that I ask."
The Admiral sat down again. With that, Chris Larrabee left the officer hoping that the Admiral was as sure about this as he seemed because Chris himself was nowhere near that confident. Wellington watched him go and let out a sigh before pressing the comm unit on his desk.
"Judy, what time does Lieutenant Travis wish to see me?"
Outside the huge picture window of the annex preceding the Admiral's inner sanctum, Lieutenant Mary Travis could see the Golden Gate Bridge under the powerful rays of the afternoon sky. The heat was nothing like that of Vulcan, of course, but then this was Earth and there should be no reason for her to expect it to be like Vulcan. There was nothing on Earth that even remotely resembled Vulcan, and Mary made a mental note to go home during her next shore leave. As a career Starfleet officer, she was not prone to questioning orders. Mary lived under the simple philosophy that as a subordinate in Starfleet's hierarchy, it did not do to question the logic of those in a higher command. What they decided was policy. What she preferred was irrelevant. It did not affect her functioning as an officer if she was required to serve with a human captain. Except that in the cold face of that logic, Mary had found herself thinking that she might be somewhat out of place on a ship full of humans, after spending so many years on Vulcan, living as one and learning to think in the same way. To anyone else in the room, Lieutenant Mary Travis was a human woman in her early 30s with a rather glacial expression most times that looked very out of place on the cool beauty of her features. The most noticeable thing about Mary was her gold hair, worn loose around her shoulders, which had been of much consternation to the Vulcans who believed hair ought to be worn in tight bangs. Fortunately, too much of Mary's human origins remained for her to cut her tresses, and though her husband would never publicly admit it, he had loved her wearing that cascade of gold freely over her shoulders. Although she had vast experience in diplomacy and negotiation, not to mention an intimate understanding of Starfleet regulations and Federation directives, she had not been a protocol officer, and that added to her apprehension. What made it worse, beyond her own fears, was the record of the commander she would be serving. Not only was he human, but he was as far from a Vulcan as she could possibly imagine. Mary did not want to be placed in a position where what she was used to would only cause friction with her captain.
The Admiral will see you now.
Wellington's secretary broke through the train of her thoughts. Mary rose to her feet and replied politely,
"Thank you."
The woman made no reaction to that, although there was something in her eyes that begged question. However, no hint as to what that might have been appeared forthcoming, so Mary saw no reason to linger. Admiral Wellington sat behind his desk waiting for her. Mary had never met the man before, although she studied all available data on him prior to this meeting. The Admiral had his own ideas on crew selection, Mary had deduced, although his choices could be rather unorthodox at times. Like now.
"You wished to see me, Lieutenant Travis?"
Wellington did not rise from his seat, nor did Mary expect him to.
"Yes, sir, I wish to request a transfer from the Maverick."
Wellington showed an almost Vulcan mask of reaction to the request. Mary had expected an emotional outburst of some kind from the man. Humans could be so unpredictable when it came to such matters. Mary preferred the symmetry of Vulcan behavior to the disarray of human emotion.
"May I have a reason?"
Wellington inquired with similar calm.
"I do not believe I would make a good protocol officer for Captain Larrabee."
"I see."
Wellington nodded. He had half expected this when he was told she wished to see him.
"Are you not breaching the chain of command by coming to me with this?"
Mary shifted uncomfortably in her stance but made no admission of guilt, even though she felt rivers of it coursing through her and reminded herself to stick to the speech she had prepared.
"According to the data regarding my transfer to the Maverick, it appears that my position was not requested by Captain Larrabee but by you. Therefore, it was my opinion that you were the one most appropriate to approach regarding a transfer."
"Is there any reason why you feel you cannot work with Chris Larrabee?"
the Admiral inquired.
"I feel nothing of the kind. I do believe, however, that he would not be receptive to the position of a protocol officer on his bridge. All my presence would accomplish would be to create an atmosphere of conflict that will be non-beneficial to the crew."
Wellington nodded and took this all in.
"Do you have problems working with humans?"
"I do not have any such problems."
Mary responded automatically, slightly incensed that he would even suggest such a thing. Could he not see that she was making the most sensible choice for everyone concerned?
"It's just that I've read his record and he's—"
Mary started to say before she stopped herself.
"You may speak your mind,"
Wellington prompted. Mary let out a sigh, trying to think of the best way to put this.
"He's a bit of a cowboy."
"I see."
Wellington's expression suddenly became very hard.
"Lieutenant, I understand that you've spent a lot of time with Vulcans, being stationed on the home world, not to mention your late husband was also Vulcan. However, Starfleet is about embracing all races and cultures, including your own. I appreciate the dilemma you face, but there is no professional reason why you should not take your place on the Maverick.
Despite her reluctance to admit it, the Admiral had a very good point. In fact, that was the point that should override all other considerations. There was no reason why she couldn't take his placement as protocol officer of the ship, and she was a Starfleet officer. Starfleet did not have to justify the reasoning behind its personnel assignments, least of all to an officer whose reasons for asking were personal.
Request for transfer denied,
Wellington said flatly, meeting her gaze directly.
You will report to the Maverick as expected at 1400 hours tomorrow. Dismissed.
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Travis, despite what you think about Captain Larrabee, he may surprise you.
Mary did not answer. When she had gone, Wellington turned to the comm unit on his desk again.
Judy, do we have anyone else from the Maverick with a problem?
Actually, he did not have a problem. The problem lay with his two daughters. They just did not see the sense in having a man his age get on a starship and going to the front. It was not right for someone with his standing in the community to embark on some damnful idealistic adventure. Perhaps they were right. Maybe a man his age had no business traipsing across the galaxy on a starship, but the one counsel he valued the most would say otherwise. He could hear all his thoughts in his head as clearly as she often sent them to him in the manner of her people, the Betazoids. Being human, now that she was gone, it felt terribly empty inside his head without her comforting voice there to reassure him whenever he was nervous of anything.
Grab on, Josiah. Grab on and ride the wind.
Of course, he would never hear her voice again or hear her thoughts in his mind. It had been almost a year since she had passed away now. Until recently, he spent each of those days since her death mourning the life they had shared together for almost 20 years. They had joined the Starfleet's medical corps together, and the promise of a future together kept him bound to Earth, instead of traveling the stars. When their first child, Mara, had been born, Josiah forgot his longing for adventure and embarked on a new journey with his new family. For years, he had forgotten those boyish dreams of moving through the stars, voyaging to places unknown on a starship. He had all he and their life together was fulfilling in ways he never dreamed an Earthbound existence could be. When she died of Xenex syndrome, Josiah moved through the days as a man lost. He buried himself in his work at Starfleet Medical, produced several papers on various research subjects, attended more symposiums and gave more lectures than he cared to admit. All to avoid coming home to a life of which she was no longer a part. It was after the Borg attack, when the casualties were brought in, that Josiah had his first taste of pure psychiatry in a long time. At Starfleet Medical, he had been nestled with so much research and administrative duties he no longer had patience. However, the Borg attack had mobilized every psychiatrist in Starfleet's ranks to lend a hand. Josiah had been responsible for counseling the survivors of the Rutherford, the man who was also its first officer. Chris Larrabee had been no stranger to loss. He accepted the death of his crew stoically because he was used to it. His wife and son had been killed in a freak shuttle accident when they had been traveling to Earth from the research station at Sirius Planum. Josiah could sense that despite his outwardly dispassionate manner to the tragedy, there was a part of Chris that was raw and still wounded from that loss. The psyche reports on Commander Larrabee seemed to indicate he had yet to cope with the secret pain still buried deep inside him. For almost a week, Chris Larrabee lay in critical condition after suffering massive head injuries. There was a moment when Josiah did not think he would make it. However, the man possessed a will to live that Josiah was certain contributed to his recovery. Chris confessed he did not like psychiatrists, a fact Josiah could tell by his initial hostility. Eventually, their relationship had been forged because Chris became his friend. Being married to a Betazoid had allowed Josiah an edge most counselors could use well. He found his empathy to their feelings made him a better analyst, and his patients trusted his judgment in all things because they believed he genuinely cared. In Chris's case, it was listening to him speak of the places he had been and the things that he had seen on a starship that made Josiah determined to see him have those experiences again. After a few weeks, Josiah made a confession to the young first officer that he would have liked to have a career in space, had circumstances been different. When Chris found out that he was the captain of the Maverick, he was still at Starfleet Medical. Josiah was the first person he told about his new posting, and after congratulations were made and the shock had worn away, Chris made a most unexpected request of him.
Come with me.
Josiah had merely stared at him in astonishment.
You can't be serious.
However, Being married to a former telepath eradicated the doubt of Chris's intent. Josiah sensed that he was genuine in his offer.
You said it yourself, Josiah. You've been running yourself ragged trying to find something to do with yourself. Why not take a chance on this? You've always wanted to go to space.
Yes, but...
Josiah stammered, trying to think of reasons why he could not go.
I have not logged a year of star time in God only knows how long.
So, I want the best counselor in the fleet, not a space ranger. As a psychiatrist, you've got the best bedside manner I've ever seen, and I ought to know, I hate you people. Your qualifications are impeccable, and I don't even have to mention your credentials for research. I could not get a better ship's counselor if I tried.
Despite all his reservations, Josiah felt himself being convinced, but there was still some resistance to the idea. The thought of leaving everything he had known for the past 20 years to embark on something completely unknown frightened him to no end, and yet it was also tantalizing.
I don't know,
Josiah managed to say, even though the gleam of desire to accept Chris's offer was being weighed down by a lifetime of responsibility to everyone but himself. Chris paused a moment before saying softly,
What would Aaliyah tell you to do if she were here?
If Aaliyah was here, this would not be a consideration,
Josiah retorted, and then felt ashamed for saying it. Chris said nothing, but the doctor could tell he had been hurt by the remark. Still, Chris was correct. Even if Aaliyah were no longer in his life, Josiah could always count on her wisdom to help him make difficult decisions.
Grab on, Josiah. Grab on and ride the wind.
Thus, Dr. Josiah Sanchez accepted a field commission on board the USS Maverick as its ship's counselor. When he told his children of his intention to leave Earth, they had thought he had finally gone senile because of grief. He understood their reservations and knew their fears well. They had just lost their mother and were afraid of losing their father to space. If they had been children, he could appreciate their fear for him, but they were adults. They had lives on of their own, and he had to make one for himself now that Aaliyah was gone. Although they were still ambivalent about the decision he made, eventually they were unable to deny the first semblance of happiness their father had felt since the loss of their mother. The advantage of being married to a Betazoid and having offspring with telepathic ability, Josiah decided, was nothing could be hidden from them. With such complications removed, Josiah was able to convince his children this was right for him. So now he was here, standing in the house he had shared with Aaliyah for almost 20 years. He had discharged the housekeeper who had gone into the employ of Mara, his oldest daughter and her family, early this morning. The furniture was sealed to prevent deterioration, with all the family heirlooms and valuables were placed in storage. Josiah stared at the lone duffel bag at his feet and wondered how it was possible for him to cram 30 years into such a small space. He looked at the polished wooden walls and the Betazoid carvings his wife loved to collect hanging on them. Josiah ran his fingers along the sofa and winced because it felt odd with the plasticine over the fabric. He and Aaliyah had picked the lounge suit together in New Orleans, almost 10 years ago. The loss of her threatened to overwhelm him at that moment, more than the emptiness of the house ever could. He swallowed hard, controlling the emotions struggling to surface. In reaction, Josiah picked up his bag and stepped outside. The sun was warm on his face and he looked up at the star he had called home for 3 decades. The sky was a brilliant blue and he tried to see through the veneer of sunshine covering the planet Earth to what lay beyond. He could not see the Maverick, but he knew it was there. Taking a deep breath, he decided to stop wasting time. Touching the new comm badge on his chest, he spoke out tentatively, uncertain whether the device was working or not.
Hello? This is Counselor Sanchez. I'm ready to come up now.
The voice on the other end was a cheerful female who was somewhat amused by the manner of his request.
Certainly, Counselor, hold position and we'll beam you on board immediately.
Thank you,
he replied, as the glow of golden specks danced around his eyes, preparing to carry him away from all that he knew. Josiah Sanchez cast a final glimpse at the place that had been his home for so long and said a final farewell.
Goodbye, Aaliyah.
Chapter 2. Arrivals.
Mother, we have stopped moving,
the boy said softly. Mary opened her eyes and looked at her son. It took a second to react to his words because she was distracted by the absence of the familiar hum of the shuttle's engines and by the stationary stars outside her window. In the distance, she could see the glimmer of light emanating from the starbase from which they had departed only a short time ago. The star Sol was peeking over the curve of the planet Earth, illuminating the enormous structure in the distance. Glancing at the gold pendant watch given to her by her late husband, Mary saw that it was drawing close to the time when she was expected to report to the Maverick. Despite herself, she felt a hint of apprehension at why they had come to a stop. With all the reservations she already had about this assignment, she did not wish to be late for her first day as protocol officer to the USS Maverick. As it was, she was certain that Captain Larrabee would be as ambivalent to her presence as she was to being posted to a starship, still wishing that they had left her alone on Vulcan. Unfortunately, with the recent Borg attack decimating the ranks of good officers, Starfleet had to pool its resources to fill positions on board starships.
"I'll see what is causing the delay,"
she replied coolly, rising to her feet.
"William, you will remain here,"
Mary instructed. Half Vulcan or not, boys at William's age were intensely curious about everything that moved, and she did not want him to be wondering about if there was something malfunctioning on the ship.
"Yes, Mother,"
he said obediently and returned his attention to the learning pad on his lap. These days, she noticed he no longer argued with her the way he used to when his father had been alive. Despite her attempts not to show her sorrow to her son, she felt a sliver of grief appear in her heart. Allowing it no more than a second's existence, she crushed the emotion from her heart and continued walking towards the shuttle cockpit. William had always questioned everything because that is how his father had raised him to be. Sion believed a mind was wasted if it did not strive to expand the boundaries of its knowledge. Unfortunately, such belief when raising a child could be a double-edged sword. It gave William the idea that it was necessary to question and investigate everything. Not anymore. Since his father was killed in the Borg attack, as many Starfleet officers had been during that battle, William retreated into a world of books and studies. By Vulcan standards, he was still a child since he had not reached the age where he was required to undertake Serac's disciplines. As much as Mary wanted to indulge his human side before the Vulcan took too much control, William seemed isolated and marked with a profound sadness. He had been close to his father and was still too young to manage his grief with Vulcan stoicism. Not that age allowed her to cope any better. Mary reached the cockpit and found a fresh-faced ensign studying his controls with growing frustration. At her arrival, he quickly rose to his feet and stammered an uncoordinated response.
"I'm sorry, Lieutenant Travis. We seem to be having some sort of problem with the propulsion system. I can contact the Maverick, and have you beamed aboard if you like."
"That will be fine,"
Mary nodded.
"What is going on?"
the other passenger of the shuttle demanded as she made her way up the aisle. Mary and the ensign looked over her shoulder and saw a petite, dishonored beauty advancing towards them with an expression of determination on her face. The pips on her uniform indicated she was a lieutenant, possibly an engineer. She met Mary's gaze and offered a warm smile, having come to the conclusion it was very likely that she and Mary would soon to be shipmates.
"Hi, I'm Lieutenant Pemberton,"
she announced herself cheerfully to both Mary and the ensign.
"Lieutenant Travis,"
Mary returned her smile as the confident young woman who immediately stepped into the cockpit without being asked.
"Engineer?"
she ventured a guess.
"Chief Engineer Julia Pemberton at your service,"
she said proudly with a little salute that made Mary warm immediately to her.
"What's the problem?"
Julia glanced at the anxious pilot who could not make the ship go and felt very intimidated by the presence of the chief engineer in the face of his blunder.
"He says that there is something wrong with the propulsion,"
Mary answered for him.
"Okay,"
Julia nodded, itching to get in there and see what it was this ensign had done to what would soon be one of her shuttles. By the looks of him, he had trouble distinguishing what was an EPS conduit and what was a plasma manifold. The Maverick was due to launch in less than 24 hours and Julia was impatient to get on board the vessel before that happened. She would have been here sooner, but she had spent the last 6 months on DS3 and had not managed to get back sooner. Aside from a million things that needed doing before launch, she was impatient to get to her first command without wasting time on this rookie kid who looked like he had no idea what he was doing.
"Let me get in there and take a look."
"Yes, sir."
The ensign nodded and stepped aside and allowed her to slide into the pilot's seat. She studied the readings on the controls and quickly found the problem. Obviously, this ensign required a refresher course in shuttle mechanics or at least a good kick in the rear. However, Julia decided that it was not her place to make either recommendation. She had her own schedule to keep and it was more expedient if she just fixed the problem, so they could get going instead of complaining about it.
"The warp core energy readings are fluctuating,"
she declared after a moment of quick examination of all the sensor readings.
This is indicative of an imbalance with the output ratio of the field coils. I can fix it from here.
Lucky you are on board, Lieutenant,
the ensign remarked with a sigh of relief.
I think I need a refresher in shuttle mechanics.
He mirrored Julia's thoughts with astounding clarity. Mary watched Julia Pemberton with mild fascination as her fingers flew over the pads of the cockpit controls, utterly consistent with one who was confident of her abilities and had no room for doubt on that perception. Mary did not know Julia, but she could tell immediately that the woman knew her job and she knew it exceedingly well. Allowing her gaze to shift away from the chief engineer, Mary found herself peering out the window of the cockpit, at the ship that lay just beyond the hull of this small craft. Against the canvas of brilliant stars, Mary could see the faint silhouette of the Maverick in the not-too-far distance. Although she had been in Starfleet for many years, most of her assignments had been earthbound and she had not seen many ships in her time, certainly not a heavy battle cruiser that was a galaxy-class starship. The Maverick was very impressive, having the formidable lines of a warship and yet the sleek beauty of an explorer-class vessel at the same time. Mary swallowed hard, trying not to let the sight of the ship intimidate her. The lack of experience on board a starship, not to mention she was probably going to have to deal with a hostile captain, did not make her feel better. If she was to maintain any professional balance with the captain, she would have get herself under control. Mary's thoughts shifted back to the present from her reminiscing when a loud hum broke the silence of the moment. The control panels leapt to life underneath Julia's deft fingers settling into the familiar drone of normal engine function. Julia rose to her feet and regarded the ensign.
Put in a repair order when you get on board the Maverick. I have a feeling this is going to be a recurring problem. I think the field coils may need replacing.
Yes, sir. I'll do that for sure.
How do you know it is a recurring problem?
Mary asked as the two women returned to their seats.
Oh, I can tell. The hum was not right.
You can tell by the hum?
Mary stared at her, suitably impressed.
Yeah. Harmonics are everything. You can detect phase shifts, energy fluctuations, and even radiation flux. Someone told me once that a good starship engineer knows every sound his or her ship makes. I do.
She smiled.
Considering this is my first tour of duty on a starship, I am pleased to hear that.
So, what did you do?
Julia inquired since the statuesque blonde was not wearing a uniform but instead a form-fitting dress that accentuated her curves and made Julia feel rather drab in her own uniform.
I'm the new protocol officer,
Mary said nervously.
Diplomatic Corps.
Julia nodded in understanding.
I didn't think that was a standard crew assignment.
Apparently Admiral Wellington felt the captain would require one. I am not so certain.
She sighed.
Oh, the captain's not so bad.
Julia replied, able to see that the woman was quite nervous about her role on the Maverick even though she seemed outwardly collected. Julia could tell that she was trying hard to maintain her professional calm and felt enough sympathy to try and ease some of her fears.
You've served with Captain Larrabee before?
Mary inquired, unable to hide her curiosity over what her new commanding officer was like. Official records reduced information to the bare facts, and while useful, Mary found that it rarely contained half of what was really needed.
Yes, I was with him on the Rutherford.
She said quietly and forced the images of that last terrible battle from her mind that often surfaced whenever the Rutherford was mentioned.
I think he asked for me for this assignment.
What is he like?
The new protocol officer asked when they came to a pause near her seat. William was still engrossed in the contents of his datapad now the shuttle resumed its advance towards the Maverick.
Well, on the Rutherford, he was first officer and probably more approachable than he'll be on the Maverick now that he is in command. He always got the job done and gave the impression no matter how bad things got, he always had a handle on it. Great sense of humor and not always by the book. Of course, he changed after his wife and son died.
That would change anyone.
Mary remarked, aware about that much of his history.
In fact, I can appreciate that myself.
She said enigmatically and returned to her seat before Julia could investigate that remark further. He was one of the first command officers to board the USS Maverick. As security chief, he had felt it necessary to greet everyone stepping off the transporter pad. Ordinarily, this task would be undertaken by Transporter Chief Rayne Noll, but Lieutenant Commander Ezra Standish preferred a face-to-face meeting with those he would be working with, rather than basing his judgment on what was available in their official records. As student of human behavior,
He found it an effective method of getting to know the people he would be serving with in the future and detecting those he knew would give him trouble later. Of course, as security chiefs went, Ezra was hardly conventional himself. Captain Larrabee had worked with him before and tolerated his penchant for running gambling and betting pools even though it was strictly against regulations. However, Ezra ran honest games and his extracurricular activities was a shot in the arm for crew morale, now more than ever considering where their mission was taking them. On the other hand, a man so accustomed to running games and under-the-table activities was more adept than anyone else in ferreting them out himself. Since he was keeping a vigil on everyone who came on board the ship, Ezra had a chance to meet all the command officers. The captain had been one of the first to arrive, which was not surprising since this was his first command. Chris and Ezra had served together years ago, and Ezra had a chance to tender his personal thanks to the man for recommending him for this assignment. Even though the risk factor was high, there was no doubt that the position could make a career if Ezra was so inclined to think about his future in those terms. The first officer, Commander Buck Wilmington, was a stark contrast to the captain. While Chris Larrabee was somber and calculated in every facet of his personality, Buck Wilmington was happy-go-lucky, casual and generally amusing to say the least. As a first officer to Captain Larrabee, Ezra found the match to be damn near perfect because while crew members might feel anxious about approaching Chris, who could be as intimidating as all hell when he felt the need, Buck was the exact opposite. Ezra, who rarely warmed to people upon first meeting, could safely say he liked the man immediately. Of course, the fact he eyed every woman in the place on their way to the bridge like they were part of an open buffet did not bode well for the virtue of the Maverick's female crew. Counselor Sanchez was another kettle of fish as well, approachable but not as enthusiastic as their first officer. The man seemed perfectly suited as a counselor, possessing this inner calm that was probably very soothing for those who came to him for aid. It did surprise Ezra, however, that for a man who was Starfleet medical for almost 30 years, he had come aboard with the manner of a first-year cadet. He gawked in wonder with his dark eyes and asked questions about everything. Ezra answered his questions patiently, reminding himself of how excited he was the first time he had come aboard a starship. As he waited in the transporter room for the last of the bridge officers, Lieutenant Commander Alexandra Stiles, the science officer, Ezra wondered what she was like. Her records indicated she had spent most of her time on Deep Space Nine and had been captured during one of the many battles between the Federation and Cardassian Dominion Alliance. Lieutenant Commander Stiles had spent 6 months in a Cardassian prison, and knowing what Cardassians did to their prisoners, Ezra was somewhat surprised to learn that after her convalescence, Stiles had enlisted in Starfleet courses for enhanced tactical and combat training, hardly the vocation of someone in the sciences. He supposed he could not blame her for wanting to defend herself with lethal prowess, considering she would have spent every day of her incarceration with the Cardassians under torture.
Lieutenant Commander Alex Stiles to USS Maverick, I am ready to transport.
Ezra heard a voice emanating from the transporter panel before him.
Stand by.
Ezra said automatically and activated the transporter controls to bring their new science officer on board. The transporter pad flickered before her in a shimmering curtain of gold speckles that eventually settled to form the shape of an exceedingly beautiful woman. Tall and lithe, she moved off the transporter pad with the grace of a cat, and while her muscles looked worked to perfection, there could be no doubt she was anything but female. She wore her jet-colored hair loose and the luster of it seemed to accentuate her exotic features, indicating a background of mixed human parentage. With her golden skin and brown eyes, Ezra could almost guarantee that almost every man on the ship would be lusting after her as soon as she came into their sight. Himself included.
Welcome aboard, Commander.
Ezra walked forward and introduced himself. She regarded him with eyes that seemed so much older than they really were, and Ezra found himself wondering what horrors she had seen in her lifetime, and considering her history, gathered that it was probably better than he did not know or ask for that matter.
Thank you.
She answered softly. Her eyes darted around the transporter pad in quick study of everything.
I'm Security Chief Ezra Standish.
He extended his hand, which she took just to be polite if her body language was anything to judge.
Pleased to meet you, Chief.
She replied, sizing him up quickly and uncertain whether or not she trusted him yet. Ezra could tell immediately that she did not trust anyone readily.
Relax, Commander.
Ezra replied with a smile.
I do not bite.
That's good to know. But unfortunately, I do.
With that, she walked out of the transporter room, not waiting for him. Ezra stared after her for a moment and then broke into a grin and followed her.
Buck Wilmington looked up at from his pad at his friend and captain, who was pacing the floor of his ready room like a man about to face a firing squad. Although they had known each other for years, had shipped out of the academy at the same time and were probably as close as two men could get despite being separated by time and space, it was the first time Buck had ever served with Chris as first officer. When Chris had asked for him as first officer, Buck had understood why immediately. Chris was not a good people person, and Buck was unashamed to admit he was. Chris tended to be aloof and somewhat glacial, and his choice of first officer was based upon balancing his imposing manner with his crew. Personality aside, they worked well together because Buck was unafraid of telling Chris exactly what he thought, almost to the point of insubordination. After Sarah and Adam Larrabee had passed on, Buck Wilmington had been the only person who had kept Chris from slipping into a dark abyss of despair from which he would have never emerged. Buck had refused to give up on his old friend, and even though their friendship had suffered because he had been forced to keep Chris's head above water, it had been worth the result. Buck had regretted nothing because he had understood when he began that sometimes, to save a friendship, one had to be willing to sacrifice it. Buck looked up from his data pad containing all the information about crew evaluations.
"Relax, Chris. You're wearing a hole in the carpet."
"The protocol officer just came on board," Chris responded automatically. "I'll let her settle in and then I'll get her in here. I don't need to see her immediately."
Buck tried to suppress a smile but did not quite manage it.
"Captain's prerogative, of course. Although I might point out that she's just a protocol officer, not a three-headed Denebian slime devil."
Chris stopped pacing and gave Buck a look.
"We haven't seen her yet."
Buck rolled his eyes and shook his head in resignation, deciding that he was not going to pull Chris out of his hostile opinion if his captain did not wish to be extracted.
"Just try to keep an open mind when you do meet her and watch your temper. You know how charming you can be around the ladies."
"Very funny.
This Tanner kid has got an interesting history,"
Buck commented as he studied the data on Lieutenant Vin Tanner, their helmsman and navigation officer.
"He that good?"
"He was the only one who kept his head on the bridge of the Rutherford when everything went to hell. He's Vulcan but raised by human parents,"
Chris replied, grateful for the chance to talk about someone else other than their protocol officer.
"You've read the profile. He's Vulcan physiologically but has none of the baggage they do. He tends to shy away from people, so if you don't mind, aside from keeping an eye on our new ensign, keep an eye on Vin as well."
"You really like this kid."
Buck looked at Chris in interest and knew that it was not often he took an interest like this.
"Well, he's had a rough time. He just looks like he's struggling to fit in, and being neither Vulcan nor human makes that hard."
"I hear you."
Buck nodded in understanding and made a note to have a talk with the lieutenant when he had the chance.
"Who else has arrived?"
Chris asked, knowing that it was just another attempt to pass the time before Lieutenant Travis arrived. Fortunately, Buck knew it too.
"I've been told that Counselor Sanchez is here. Standish has been exemplary getting everyone settled in."
"He just wants to know who's who,"
Chris said with a faint smile as he stopped pacing and went to his desk.
"Incidentally, if he asks you for a game of poker, be afraid. Be very afraid."
Buck was rather offended by the warning when he considered himself quite the card player.
"Chris, I don't get beaten in cards or in love."
Chris rolled his eyes and returned with a skeptical drawl.
"Right, just keep your eye on your credits and your latinum in either case."
"I don't have any latinum."
"That's right. And if you get into a game with Security Chief Standish, you never will either."
Buck said nothing, and Chris knew the moment he had a chance, Buck was going to seek out Ezra Standish to find out if Chris's warning was at all justified. The captain sighed, deciding that Buck was only going to learn the hard way.
"By the way, how's Josiah doing?"
"I haven't seen him yet."
The exec was making it a point to say hello to all the senior level officers before the launch to introduce and familiarize himself with the people he would be working with during the voyage. He had to confess the counselor was a few rungs down his list now, but Chris's inquiry made him reevaluate the decision.
"Do you want me to?"
Buck was aware Chris was concerned about how the counselor was fitting in because the man had not logged any space time in years. Chris pursed his lips as he considered the idea.
"Do that, but don't make it sound like you're checking up on him. He lost his wife a year ago, and it's been difficult for him coming to terms that he has to go on without her."
For a minute neither man spoke, and Buck suddenly understood why Chris had been so determined to get Josiah Sanchez as his ship's counselor. As someone who lost his wife and son and never recovered the loss, not really in Buck's opinion, Chris's empathy for Josiah's loss was also a part of his own self-healing. Chris of all people could empathize with Counselor Sanchez's grief over the loss of his wife.
"Sure, Chris."
Buck nodded before getting to his feet. There was much to do before launch tomorrow, and he had covered everything he had to with the captain for the moment.
Hey, Chris?
Buck paused in his advance to the door and glanced over his shoulder at his old friend.
What?
Chris asked, not really paying attention to his first officer since he was busy poring over Lieutenant Travis' profile on his datapad.
It'll be good working together. I've missed you.
Chris raised his eyes to his old friend and eased back into his chair with a slight nod.
Me too, Buck. Me too.
Lieutenant Vintaner had been watching her for some time now. He looked at her strawberry-colored hair and liked how it shimmered under the lighting of the ship's mess hall, the social center of the Maverick. She sat at the bar, talking to someone from engineering, radiating a smile that just reached into his chest and made his stomach flutter each time she presented it. Vint swallowed, telling himself that if he felt like this, he ought to be doing something about it, not sitting around like some terrified schoolboy, envisioning in his head for the 100th time how he should approach her. He was no kid but a man and she was a woman. It could not possibly be that difficult to strike up a conversation. Of course, he said that, but in truth the reality was far more different than his optimistic view of things. It was hard for him. It always had been. Being full Vulcan but having none of the disciplines or the upbringing necessary to be Vulcan because of his human foster parents, Vin found himself on the outside of Vulcan culture. Always staring in, he knew being a part of it was something he would never achieve. He could accept that if being human was any easier. It was not. He remained poised on the periphery of both and yet was part of neither. You can do this, he told himself. All he had to do was stand up and go say hello. Standing up from the far end of the counter, he walked towards her, drawn by the sound of her laughter, which reminded of a bright summer's day like he used to know on the world where he and his foster parents had been marooned for 12 years. He never felt like this before and told himself that someone so pretty could not be like all the others. Vin approached Lieutenant Charlotte Richmond, who had her back turned to him when he greeted her with a restrained hello. She swiveled around on her chair to face him, her eyes moving up and down with approval before she replied,
"Hello yourself."
"I thought I would introduce myself,"
he said, trying to remember how it was done from his observation of other human males. He hoped he did not mess it up. He really did like her.
"My name is Lieutenant Tanner, Vin Tanner."
Her eyes widened and laughed.
"Tanner, you're the elf, the Vulcan elf."
The manner in which she made the statement indicated it was not a term of endearment but rather of derision. Anything further Vin was going to say was immediately forgotten because he turned around and started walking away, her tittering laughter still ringing in his ears, with her companion joining in for good measure. Vin's cheeks burned with embarrassment, but it was nothing in comparison to the hurt he felt because once again, he was given a stark reminder of just how things were for him. He started walking towards the door, wanting to hide away when suddenly he heard a voice call out to him through the darkness, at the corner of the bar. He paused and looked up, spotting the shadowy figure as she emerged from her own hiding place. For a minute, he just stared at her because he thought he had all the bases covered when it came to fading into the background. She had taken a seat near the door normally reserved for couples interested in privacy while still enjoying the setting of the premises, watching everyone silently, including him. He gathered she had bore witness to his humiliation at the hands of Lieutenant Richmond.
"She's not worth it,"
Alex Stiles remarked as she sat forward enough in her seat so he could see her. Although taking part in someone's love life was not something she cared or bothered to indulge, Alex had seen Vin Tanner working up the nerve to approach Charlotte Richmond. A part of her was so touched by the effort in his face she actually hoped it would work out for him. Unfortunately, it had not, and for the first time in a long time, she felt a wave of sympathy when she saw the hurt in his eyes after the woman's rejection.
"It's not her,"
Vin managed to say once he got over his surprise at her appearance. He observed her for a moment and realized she was very beautiful, a different kind of beautiful from Charlotte but nevertheless stunning. Of course, it was not easy to tell in the dim lighting, but while he may not have had much experience with women, Vin knew that much at least.
"It's me."
"That's a load of nonsense. There's no excuse for being stupid and cruel, and that's what she is. Don't think any less of yourself because she's confused being mean with witty. Look, not all women are like her, and you'll find someone one day who can get past the Vulcan and see what's inside you. Don't waste your time trying to be something else. It's just not worth it."
"Thank you,"
he answered, genuinely surprised that such an awful experience could be followed by such a pleasant one.
"You're welcome."
She smiled and returned to the shadows, indicating as far as she was concerned, She had said her piece. Vin wanted to talk some more but had the impression she liked being left alone because he'd be in the exact same place if he wanted to hide too.